Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Human trafficking is the trade of people for forced labor or sex. It also includes the illegal extraction of human organs and tissues, and is an extremely ruthless and dangerous industry plaguing our world today. Most believe human trafficking occurs in countries with no human rights legislation. This is a myth. All types of human trafficking are alive and well in most of the developed countries of the world, like the United States, Canada, and the UK. It is estimated that $150 billion a year is generated in the forced labor industry alone. It is also believed that 21 million people are trapped in modern-day slavery, exploited for sex, labor, or organs. Most also believe since they live in a free country, there is a built-in protection against such illegal practices. But for many, this is not the case. Traffickers tend to focus on the most vulnerable in our society. But trafficking can happen to anyone. The book that we're featuring this evening is In Chains, The Dangerous World of Human Trafficking, with my special guest, journalist and author, and host of the radio program House of Mystery, Alan R. Warren. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Alan R. Warren.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Thank you very much. Another very, very interesting book, talking about another aspect of an area that we're just gaining an interest and an insight into, which is human trafficking, another true crime topic and something to discuss that's, like we mentioned in the introduction, plaguing our world. Tell us a little bit about why you decided to write a book. Why was this of interest to you? And tell us a little bit about this process of writing this book, In Chains, with R.J. Parker. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, actually, he approached me. It was a project that he was working on and had spent a little bit of time on. And at first, when I heard what he was doing, I was kind of not super interested. And I think that I was really unaware of what was really going on in the human trafficking world and what was real and what wasn't. You know, there's so many bad rumors out there and myths that I think I was like a lot of average people in the country thinking, yeah, I don't know, it might be okay. And so I left it and didn't bother. But after a while, he kind of kept bringing up things. So I started searching and I started looking for people that were involved in human trafficking. And when I started getting a few interviews and putting together some stories, it sort of grabbed a hold of me, because these are, when it becomes real, like when you meet someone and they actually give you their story, and
right.
You start to realize that this is happening every day, and it's happening in our country, and it's happening to people like you and I. It's happening to men, women, of all ages and of all race and all income brackets. It's not like it was just specific to the poor. Of course, they get picked on more, but so that really drew me in, and I think that it really surprised me, because all of a sudden, I had 20, 25 personal stories in human trafficking, and it just became so real. I had to follow this through. I couldn't leave it incomplete.
Now, what, as you write in the book, what comprises human trafficking? You talked about labor, sex, human organs. So tell us about what is the the magnitude of this problem. What does it all entail?
Well, now it seems to be it's really divided into a few different areas. The biggest area that most people are aware of course, is sex trafficking. You know, where someone is used for sexual pleasure for money, and they're forced into it. And the next one was the organ trafficking, which really caught me by surprise. I didn't realize it was so major. You know, people actually having their organs stolen or sold. And then the labor trafficking, of course, which we probably deal with every day but don't realize it, you know, in the farms and the restaurants and spas and salons that we used or our friends and family use. So that's kind of the main sections of human trafficking.
Now, you talk about in the book that there has been, I guess, obviously some attempts to address this incredible international problem. In January of this year, it was proclaimed National Slavery and Human Trafficking Prevention Month by the Department of Homeland Security in the U.S. You talk about the Blue Campaign, where you would wear blue day. This was January. President Obama had enacted this January 11th to show solidarity. You talk about a nonprofit organization, Polaris, which has a national human trafficking hotline collecting data since 2003, which have identified over 22,000 victims of trafficking just in the U.S. alone. And you say the Department of Justice, federally prosecuted over 900 human trafficking cases, and some of the states that were found to be most prevalent would be California, Texas, and Florida. Now, tell us a little bit about when we talked about the myth that only human trafficking is done in these countries where there's no legislation, no laws, no enforcement. We're imagining third world countries, but tell us what you've found.
Well, it's the whole world is connected on this. It just isn't happening in one place. It's happening wherever they need it to happen. And so, in the United States, it's happening as much as it's happening anywhere in the world. And in fact, probably more. There are people that are taken off the streets and used and forced into some sort of sexual slave, you know, spa prostitution ring. And they're teenage girls, boys, and then they're also used on the farms, and they're used in the different trades, and it's really just slave labor. It's all it is, and most people sort of just think that it's, you know, something that's distant, that something that goes on in countries where there's not much policing and stuff like that, and that's not the case. If anything, what the poor countries do is supply a lot of body parts for the richer countries, because it's easier to take them from poor countries and people in the countries than it is to get them out of people in the U.S. or the U.K. But of recent, that's been happening a lot too. It's not just from the poor countries. So it's really all about supply and demand. There's a big demand in rich countries, the U.S., the U.K., parts of Canada, Australia, there's other countries too, but when you have a high demand and you have a good income and wealthy people, they want something. They want things like whether it be sex, whether it be slave labor, or whether it's they need a new liver, and they have the money to buy it. And so they make the purchase, and the brokers get them from wherever they can. And different brokers have different setups. It's a massive organization, and several of them. There's not just one group. There's several. And they all have their own methods. It's like the drug trade, right? It's the same thing. It comes from all over the world, and it gets into where people can pay for it. And it's about business to the traffickers, and the people that are getting it. It's just about getting the service they want. So it's not just the little bits of things that you see in movies and TVs. It's going on all over, and it's probably going on where you live. It's probably in places you've gone, places you've gone to eat. It's just amazing how close it is to us, and we don't realize it. And that's probably the biggest misconception people have about trafficking.
You include all kinds of anecdotes and stories in this, one that demonstrates how much of a need there is for certain organs, and you even include the official or unofficial, I guess, price tags on these organs. The heart, $119,000, the small intestine, I can't remember the exact amount, but you had specific organs, specific prices. Now, people again would think, oh, geez, some lawless place where a doctor doesn't have to have these elaborate records that could be scrutinized, because you do write and include that there's only so many organs available, so many kidney transplants, and there's people with money waiting on a list. You even include people voluntarily in Chicago. So tell us a little bit about how far this goes and how could it happen in a place like the United States.
Well, right now in the U.S., we have 123,000 people that are on that wait list. And people are dying every day waiting for this. So what's happening is people with a good amount of wealth, enough to pay for things, actually end up buying their organ. And so, again, it's that supply and demand. And so, yeah, there's countries that they can get it from. These brokers have set up deals with hospitals in the U.S. as well as doctors. And what they do is they get the list and they get the organ that's needed. You're right, a kidney, a small intestine, or a stomach. It could be a liver or a heart. Shoulder seems to be a big one, and even skulls and teeth, like pieces of them. And it's going, the biggest market is in America. And so they get it wherever they have to. And so if they don't have enough coming from the poorer countries, or they can't get it there soon enough for the person that they're buying it for, they end up taking it from people in America themselves. And we come across cases where they would take it from, really, it's homeless people, it's people with no connections, or it can be younger people that they just actually steal from. So they catch them in a situation where they get them alone, and they basically, it's kind of like that story where you wake up in the bathtub without, you know, a liver, and it's almost that bad. You know, we have people that get caught up in a situation where they don't realize it. They meet someone, they go out for drinks and dinner, and the next thing they know, they've had some pieces taken. So the brokers will get it wherever they have to get it, because it's big demand and it's big money. And I don't see any end to it, because this is going to continue. There's going to be people with money enough to buy these body parts, and they need to get them. And they're not going to be waiting on a wait list with everyone else. That's just not how it is. I included that NBC News investigation that they had with a kidney broker, and how he was selling kidneys. And the FBI caught him. And, and that's a typical case. So, you know, he's selling three kidneys for $410,000. And he obtained them from poor Israeli donors for $10,000 each. So what cost him $30,000, he made $410,000 on. And this is going on. And what they talk about the fines, and that's the other thing, a little bit, a small jail time and a fine of $50,000. In his particular case, the one that we have in the book, he was sentenced to 2.5 years, and the man made, a lot of money. So that doesn't deter them at all. It doesn't stop them from doing what they're doing.
You also include the notorious, of course, everybody's scapegoat country, China, in this extraction kind of industry. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, there's Chinese hospitals, and they're run by the Communist Party, and just as a lot of things are. And they are one of the most massive, the largest harvesters of the body organs for trafficking. And what they say in 2006, I think, was the last report that I had. They actually trafficked 10,000 organs, and they took them from their prisoners, and they took them by force. And so we're not talking about, you know, people willingly saying, okay, well, you can take this or take that and pay me so much. They were just taking them. It's just too bad we're taking it. And they say that they've sold those 10,000 organs for a total of about $1 billion in U.S. money. And there's a documentary, we got a lot of that information from, called Human Harvest, and it's on China's organ trafficking. That's massive if you think about that. You know, in 1 year, their own hospitals got 10,000 organs and sold them throughout the world for $1 billion. You really have to stop and really let that sink in. 10,000 pieces of people they took by force and sold. It just, you know, I don't even know what you can say about that. Like, that's huge. This is like a whole new trend, a whole new drug industry going on. It's just a different item that they're selling. I just don't see that it's getting any better, because countries like that and Indonesia and there's so many countries out there, Brazil, that allow it to happen, and they're not trying to stop it, and they're not trying to deter it. And of course, again, you've got the demand for it. They'll fill that demand. They'll get the parts needed. And it doesn't matter about the people, the victims.
Well, you also demonstrate in this book, too, that a young child, I think 6 years old, or a young boy was left in a field missing his eyes. So we know that through the forces of human nature, greed, and again, demand and supply, that it's not much of a story down the road to imagine that people will be not in a hospital, not be in China, just be victims potentially of people that want to make some money any way they can. Let's talk about an incredible example that you include in the book, International Sex Ring. But we're talking about Albuquerque, Motel 6. But really what this story demonstrates is how, through a website like Backpage, that this can actually happen. You explain how Backpage, and through complaints and through many articles, and how Backpage facilitated this. So tell us about the Backpage, what they did, how they did it, and the fight to be able to, you know, shut down Backpage. And very, very demonstrated in this Albuquerque Motel 6 case. Tell us, as you write in the book, about this case.
For people that don't know, Backpage was like Craigslist, but it mainly focused on just want ads, specific. It was a lot more in prostitution, people meeting people, like hooking up, and it was more of that kind of a website than Craigslist. Craigslist had that, but they had so much more. Like, you could buy, you know, auto parts and fridge and stove and all that. Like, it was, you know, rent an apartment. Backpage mainly focused on meetups. And so what had happened is Backpage became one of the key places to go to. So it ended up, it would allow people to advertise an array of services that had many sexual appetites, if you will. So it included things like bondage, S&M, the Crook Encounters, you name it, it was there. You had a, you were into feet, you were into arms, you know, whatever it was,
yeah.
you could find it. And so what happened was a lot of the traffickers and I guess online pimps, you would call them, they had different types of girls that would do different things and fulfill different needs. And they would advertise them on there, and as well as answer ads. So, of course, the FBI was always on the lookout, and they're always searching for missing people or girls, mainly girls and the boys as well, that had gone missing that were possibly being trafficked. And so if they would find someone and their picture, they would do it through Backpage mainly, some on Craigslist. You know, they would see the picture and they would set up a sting and they would recover the lost person, you know, and that happened. But what happened, eventually, it was all shut down. So they shut down Backpage completely and they shut down the Craigslist, the services section. So neither one of them were going anymore. So they were left with no single place to mock, you know, the people for
right.
sexual trafficking. So what happened was now it's gone to an array of sites all over the world. So it's made the job really hard for the FBI in the sense that they've got to be constantly searching for sites all through the world and new sites. And it's changing all the time, and it's made their job a lot harder. Not that I'm for advertising sex, but I think the initial intention was to make this, you know, go away, to fix this. And by cutting those, it didn't do it. It made it worse. So now they've got so many more man hours to be involved in to try and to find these, you know, people that were kidnapped and used for sex. And what they're doing is they're finding that there's places being used like hotels and motels. And Motel 6 was one of these in one of these cases. And this is becoming a little bit more regular. It's not being used as a chain, don't get me wrong. It's being used as independent units that are owned separately, but under that banner of a chain hotel. And, of course, they always deny it. They'll say, well, we had no idea what was going on, but the evidence kind of shows that they did know what was happening, and they do know what's going on in their hotel rooms and how they're selling them. So there's still quite a few open cases on different hotels, not just that Motel 6 that we talked about.
You write in this book, too, of the growing necessary realization of the magnitude of this problem and the problem itself, and dispelling some of these myths that, as you write, that sex trafficking is not prostitution. There's, you know, that there's all these ideas that people have, how people can come to be a slave or to be human trafficked. And you've include numerous examples of how easy it can be, people duped, complex, sophisticated ruses, and just brutal ruses, like one girl in her apartment, and a man that she knew as a pimp came and said, listen, we'd like to take you out, and she said, look, I got schoolwork, and so it's a schoolgirl, and she's taken forcibly from her home, and then kidnapped and taken, and human trafficked. You talk about a case in 2006 that, again, demonstrates the difference in attitudes, again, still growing, still maturing in that realization of what really this is all involved. But this was called Free China, and you talk about her boyfriend, Johnny Allen, and how she ends up in prison. Tell us a little bit about this case that you include, very dramatic, Free China, and what happens to her.
In a typical case like this, and even like this, a lot of times it happens to girls that are unaware of this of trafficking, period, and they live in a half decent community with you know, a good neighborhood and fairly good home and parents. And in this particular case, it was a 16-year-old. And a lot of times what they're doing is they're just running away from home, or they meet someone. And this case, it was a 24-year-old, and, you know, and they become boyfriend, girlfriend in the girl's point of view. But what they're really doing is they're being lured into what's going to end up being a, you know, a sex trade business. So they get lured into it. They eventually move in with the guy, like she moved in with a 24-year-old boyfriend. And it just went from there. All of a sudden, it's too late. And he starts to force her into prostitution. And that's what happened. And so eventually she was sold out and used for sex several times. And if she tried to do any resistance, like in this case, she had been held with a gun. She had been beaten. It just an amazing. I don't get too much into the deep details, but I give you some of the basics on this. But eventually, what happens is she ended up being tried as an adult and convicted for first degree felony murder because of one of the pimp or one of the guys that, you know, the Johns that had been she had been sold to. She had fatally shot. Because she had used the purse that she had, the gun she had always had in her purse, and because of the way he was treating her when they were together, he thought, you know, she thought she was going to be killed, and so you end up with, you know, a 16-year-old that met a guy, ran away from home, and all of a sudden she's used in sex trade. And she ends up in a murder and ends up being put in jail. And the Free Cynthia, the whole thing about her story is in a documentary that came out in 2011. And they're looking for people to help get her free because people don't think she should be in jail until, like, I think it's the age 69 for her before she's even up for parole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, she really, you know. And this is not. This is going on in the States big time. There's so many teenage girls meeting men and thinking they've got a boyfriend. They eventually get talked into moving in with the boy, and all of a sudden they get moved to another city. They change their hair color, change their looks, and then they put them up for a prostitution, and they start forcing them to have sex. If they refuse anything, they get beat, they get choked, they get raped savagely. It's a terrible situation. And you can end up like Cynthia Brown, where you end up actually in defense of yourself killing someone, and you end up being put away for your whole life. And it's just a terrible scenario, and it doesn't come out any good for anybody.
Yes, it's incredible, too, that, again, unlikely advocate Kim Kardashian, and we've heard a little bit about her fighting for people's rights, not women's rights, wrongfully convicted, or what she thinks in this case is just an unjust conviction. Kim Kardashian met with, of course, President Trump, May 2008, trying to have this case appealed. Interesting, too, that this victim, as you write in this book, not eligible for parole till she's 69 years old. In 2012, there was a situation where she might have, because it was a mandatory life for a juvenile, because she was 16 years old, was unconstitutional, but of course she was not eligible for that. And so any kind of changes in attitude towards this, like celebrities lining up to help defend her with this and plead her case, that's the kinds of things that are slow to progress, and that while this woman still sits in prison, despite celebrities and their connections.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate because now, not putting down Kim Kardashian, but the problem is we need people that have more more say in what they do.
Sure.
and more credibility, I guess, is what it is. Because, like, you know, that scenario happened with her and Donald Trump, and nothing changed. Nothing, you know, it's almost like something to put on your Facebook page, and then next week it's something else. We need people to really get involved and do the work and make something happen. I appreciate that she's making an effort and she brought it to everyone's attention, but we've got to stay on it. We can't just have that and you make the news cycle and you smile and take some pictures and then everybody walks away. Nothing goes on. The people, we have to keep on this. Otherwise, it's not going to stop.
Yes, absolutely. Let's use this opportunity, Alan, to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is ShipStation. When you're selling online, getting your orders out can be a real pain. Time-consuming, expensive. So many carriers to choose from. How do you know you're making the best choice? That's why you need ShipStation.com. It's the fastest, easiest, and most affordable way to manage and ship your orders. ShipStation helps you get your orders out quickly, save money on shipping costs, and keep your customers happy. No matter where you're selling, Amazon, Etsy, your own website, ShipStation brings all your orders into one simple interface, making them really easy to manage from any device, even your cell phone. ShipStation works with all of the major carriers, including USPS, FedEx, UPS, even Amazon Fulfillment, so you can compare and choose the best shipping solution for you and your customer. They even offer big discounts on shipping costs. Now, any business can access the same postage discounts that are usually reserved for large Fortune 500 companies. You'll always know that you're getting the best deal. No wonder ShipStation is the number one choice of online sellers. You'll ship more in less time with the best rates available. And right now, True Murder listeners can ship and try ShipStation free for 60 days when you use promo code TRUEMURDER. There's absolutely no risk. You can start your free trial without even entering your credit card info. Just visit ShipStation.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in True Murder. That's ShipStation.com, then enter promo code True Murder. ShipStation.com. Make ship happen. Now, Alan, I mentioned talking about a victim, Marinella, a 17-year-old, and she was at her apartment, as I mentioned, and this pimp named Cornell and another gentleman named Marius Nedjelovanu talked about a barbecue. Can you tell us a little bit about this particularly disturbing case and what happened to her and how long it took her to get back to Romania?
Well, like so many of the others, it's a typical person that's struggling to survive, make rent, tuition, and they end up being caught up in something where they think they're just being part of a party or a barbecue and meeting friends and stuff, and they get taken, and they get forced into this sexual situation where they're used, they're trafficked really to people that have money, and sometimes they never get out, and the few that do, it takes away their life. It takes away almost their whole life. There's almost nothing left. By the time they come out, they're already close to 30 or late 20s, and it just ruined their whole life. It's really hard for me to get into a lot of the details of these cases we wrote, because we did most of them last year. But they all end up much the same, and they all go through the same sort of thing. And the worst part, again, out of it is the traffickers that get caught, if they get caught. The prosecution rate is probably in the 20 to 30% ratio, because most of the people that are victimized won't testify, and that's one major problem. You know, getting actual people to do anything and to come to court, and a lot of times it's far too late. If they do get caught, chances are nothing much will happen to most of them. You could say probably about 75% of them get off with no, they get away with it.
Mm-hmm. In this case where you talk about Marinella, it's incredible because you get these kinds of details. On the very first day, she made 300 pounds, enough to support her family for 6 weeks. And yet she didn't get anything and would have to ask for a cigarette or a coffee, never let outside. And when she was taken to Manchester, there was 15 other girls there beaten. They were often beaten. And the break came in May 2009 when they came to avoid arrest, pardon me, Nigel Villeneuve, based on a tip. And police saw the situation there. Now, the father, which was even more disturbing, the father's involved with this, a man named Bogdan. And in courts, unlike what you say, often, most often, there's not really any prosecution or they avoid prosecution. The father got 6 years, and this Nedja Villeneuve got 21 years. And finally, in 2011, you write that Marinella returned to her parents in Romania. So an incredible ordeal, and that's just, again, like you're right, it's typical of many of the cases, whether they're from Romania or where they're from, a ruse or some forceful entry into the sex trafficking world. As you say, it's very dangerous because, obviously, you have another story in here where a couple people involved in this Motel 6, I believe, were murdered. Actually, but they were involved, and I guess the people that are running this organization didn't like how they were doing things. So, as you write in the book, this is a very dangerous world that it's being created from this human trafficking. People that will do anything with anyone, treat anyone like a victim, and make anyone a victim. And if I guess it's a precarious situation where they might have prosecution, might be convicted, these people are, like you write, they're often intimidated from testifying at trial, but more often they just go missing, don't they?
Yeah, quite often they just disappear. Quite a few of them are in hiding, and if they do come out and you do get to see them tell their story, whether it be to an author like me or RJ, or if you're in a documentary or something, you know, they have to have their name changed and they have to have their looks altered. A lot of them live the rest of their life scared because they know that most people that are doing the trafficking have a lot of contacts. They're all over. They're in every city in the U.S., for instance. They're moving girls and people around all the time, and they have a lot of money, and they're scared. They're really scared. To go and testify, if you're lucky, one or two people in the group, in the chain of command, get put in jail for a couple of years. But there's still a lot of people that are in that trafficking group that will come get you, or they're really scared of that, or they'll get your family. And quite a bit in the stories, if you notice, you know, they get told, you know, a 14-year-old or 16-year-old girl that being held in a different city gets told, yeah, if you run away, we'll go to you. We know your family is. We'll kill your brother. We'll kill your mother. And they believe it, you know. So they're living in a total on the edge. And just because they get free doesn't mean it goes away. It's because it's still going on, and they're left in limbo, so to speak, just sitting. And, you know, and it gives you a good indication, like if people, as soon as you read the introduction, because just when we were finishing the book, it was with Robert Kraft, New England Patriot owner,
right,
when he got caught, you know, with the girls in that spa in Florida. And the whole idea is, you know, what will happen? He won't even end up in court. He won't end up in jail. You know, this multimillionaire billionaire will have a couple of $1,000 fine at max. the girls that got caught that were working in the spa all get convicted, sent back to China or wherever they're from. Most of them were from China. And then they have a tainted name because of what they got caught doing back home. And so it's ruined their reputation. And then the owner of the spa happens to have 19 other spas servicing in the U.S. And I can't say I know they're doing the same thing without being sued, but I could suggest it. You know, and that's the whole problem. So what we're saying is, we're saying the people that were actually brought over to the country saying, being told, oh, you're going to be working in a spa in the U.S. and you can get a green card and work and become an American, actually get thrown 10 to a room with a hot plate and forced to give sexual favors to people for nothing because they're told they have to work it off because they owe $50,000 or some huge number for them being brought into the country. So they do this for years. And then if they do get caught, they get convicted, sent back home with a bad record. And everyone else that's running it continues to life normal. And, you know, they could get a $2,000 fine. Not a whole lot of money to someone with that kind of money. So we're not ending this. It's just kind of going on and on. And not enough is being done. I think that's the biggest concern I have. And it's the biggest thing that the book is trying to, I mean, I hope it leaves someone when you read it, when you come at the end of the book, I hope you realize that all of this is happening around us in 2019, today, and the people that are doing this to our kids and other people are really getting away scot-free and they're making money.
You talk about even more disturbing trend is in the Middle East and North Africa, what you call the MENA region or the MENA region, a population of 380 million. They have laws against human trafficking, but no enforcement whatsoever. And the biggest concern, of course, is the child trafficking. 62% of victims there are children. Most are Asians, Sahara Africans, and 35% of females traffic mainly for labor. We haven't talked about labor and how extensive that is, that labor slavery. Tell us about just how that works.
Well, the forced labor, you know, and this one is really, really gets me because you know, we have a government in the U.S. that is really focused on, you know, homeland security and immigration and all this stuff, and they're talking about forced labor and you know, you hear all these stories. But the government in the United States and all of the people in the immigration detention centers, like the 200 centers that are there, and more than, 48, 50,000 people are now held there. Two-thirds of those places are run by private companies. So they have contracts with our federal government to run these facilities. And, of course, a lot of attention has been brought on, but it's more political. You see Democrats talking, you know, kids in cages and no toilet paper and food, and then you've got the other side saying, well, they're here illegally. Like, you kind of got this battle going for politics.
Sure.
But under that, these two companies with the current administration, they made $2.8 billion to run these detention centers with, you know, 52,000 beds, even though they probably have more people in there. So you've got these detention centers where you've got these people that are here, perhaps some of them have lied, some of them are waiting for their hearing, and some are illegal. I guess it's kind of a mix. And then they're told that they have to work. So even though the American prison labor system abolished the whole idea of prisoners having to work, what they're doing is they're telling them that we'll give you $1 a day in compensation for each day you work. So you have to volunteer. None of those people are convicted. So you're getting paid a dollar a day, and then they're taking them out to farms and different places and working them full time like a normal person would work for, let's say, $15 an hour. So
right.
These companies are paying them to do this, and they're only having to pay their people a dollar a day. They made over $2 billion, I believe it was, from this type of labor. So when your federal government is really involved in trafficking labor, the attention doesn't really get focused on anybody else doing it. So it's going on in all sorts of levels in the country. So it's a real mess. But I think my point is that if your federal government is doing it, then then why punish people that are doing it that are not part of the government? Like it doesn't make sense. We have to come up with a better solution to this, because what's going on now when you talk about in the states, other companies, there's places that will get illegals and force them to work on ranches and picking fruits and servitude, servicing and maid work and all that sort of stuff. And a lot of them get paid almost nothing, if they get paid at all. And they have a terrible living conditions, and they're just slave labor. It's like the modern day slave is what it is. But like I said, you've got a government in the same business.
You write even more disturbing, though. We talk about labor or forced trafficking, recruiting child soldiers, and if that isn't bad enough, giving sex slaves to them for recruitment rewards. And that's how bad it can be in other countries, you write.
Yeah. More so than in the U.S., yeah, with the military. The military enslavement goes on a lot in other countries, more so than in North America. But, they're taking boys as young as 12, and they really get stolen and forced into this. And sometimes the parents want them to. Sometimes they make them. And some of the stories I have in here, you see it can go either way. Someone's forced into it, or someone's gone missing, and they've been taken. And actually, it's pretty brutal when you go through some of these stories, especially the Ishmael one.
Yeah.
When they're in the village and just some of the details you get from him, and how he was just going out looking for work with his talent, and then all of a sudden becomes forced into this military where he's supposed to be killing and burning people. I can't summarize that. You really have to read that from that perspective. Now, that's definitely something you're going to you don't see so much in the U.S. this kind of thing going on, but you see it more in the third world countries. Definitely an eye-opener.
Mm-hmm. You talk about, too, the practical ways, in reality, how these guys avoid conviction, but also how some of these women, girls, are treated. And you say they're treated as illegal immigrants and deported. So even when sometimes they get to authorities, even if they were, like you write, that the police wouldn't just inform the traffickers of what goes on and scuttle the entire case, that sometimes the country is very not interested in addressing this issue, and so they deport them, don't they?
Oh, quite often. Quite often. And the one immigration visa that we have that's available to people that were forced into this sort of labor or sex sort of trade is limited to how many they give out. And since they've been doing it, not even half of them have been given out. It's almost like it's almost like they're just for show. They don't actually use it. and nobody tries to get help for these people that have been victimized. They are forced into this and then treated terribly, left in jail, and then sent back home if they come from another country. And for them to get that T1 visa is almost impossible. It just doesn't happen. And the stats show you that. It's a vicious circle. And the people that are being used don't get help by the legal system. All the legal system does right now in the U.S. or Canada is get them out of the situation and then send them back to their country. And they're not in any better situation. They've got a terrible record, and they've been through an awful ordeal that'll stay with them the rest of their life. And when they go home, of course, they're shunned. They're not supported or helped, and people don't treat them well. People disown them. It's just a vicious circle going around and around, and it's not a good outcome. We're not helping the victims in this case.
Before we talk about what kind of help and who might possibly be helping them, this is something I didn't know, and you provide a photo. Tell us about the importance and the significance of tattoos.
Oh, yeah. You know, and that was kind of, I think a lot of people don't realize. That's why it's kind of the book. We tried to make sure we included as much as we could with the amount of material we had without getting too detailed, but enough that you can realize, wow, the truths and what's really going on. And in that, were you talking about the tattoo? It's they're actually finding survivors of sex traffic work. And this, in the particular case we talk about, is in Wisconsin. And it's a whole new way of exploiting. So they're actually branding them with tattoos. We've included, I believe we have one or two pictures. And it looks like a barcode, like it's something you would buy in the groceries when you go pick up your groceries, you know, the boxes and the cans and all that. And they have those little barcodes, and they can just scan them, and the price comes up and you pay. So that's what they're looking like. And they're doing it, and it seems to be they're doing it on women and children victims, and it seems to be all sex trafficking so far. We didn't come across anything, or the FBI reports it's only in commercial sex trafficking. So I think they had somewhere around 34 to 59 in 2017. So, you got a picture of it in the book. You'll see there's actually a few different ones, and they're mainly done on the wrist, or they're done on the back part, the lower part of the neck.
We talked, you mentioned how people could be helped, what is going on, and I mentioned Polaris and the Blue Campaign. You also include United, UNOD, I believe it is, and some of the drafts of the anti-human trafficking legislation, some inroads in Armenia, Lebanon, South Africa, actually also allowed to train police departments in Burkina Faso, Guyana, Nigeria, Togo, Ukraine, and South Africa. And then they're also training border guards, prison police officers, prosecutors, and judges in some of those countries, again, including Laos, Moldavia, Nigeria, Ukraine. So there is, you have to admit, there is some realization, even though you have a pessimistic outcome, this isn't going away, it's going to get worse. There is some initiatives to try to address this, aren't there, that you include in the book?
Oh, yeah. You know, we've included the hotline as well for human trafficking, and we've given tips or things to look for, how to recognize and report human trafficking. There's a whole chapter in there about that, because it's the key thing in solving this. I think I'm pessimistic mainly because the legal system has done nothing to really remedy it. It's not really set up to help the victims. And it's proven that over and over again, and it's still to this day. And the thing is, the human trafficking is getting worse in all areas, whether it's sexual labor or body parts. And this is continuing, and there doesn't seem to be enough awareness of it. The average person could still go up and say, "Have you heard about trafficking?" And they'll just sort of look at you, you know. And they're not going out looking for it. They're not seeing it in their spas. They're not looking to see if someone is being mistreated in a restaurant or anything like that. We're just not really focused or paying attention to it. So I think that's my issue with it, and that's the more of the meaning of the book. The nonprofit organizations like Polaris and things like that, and even WHO, the World Health Organization, only sort of have so much impact in the country and in the world. They do a lot of promoting and talking about it, and the Blue Month and all that stuff. But still, I bet you if you asked almost everyone around you and everyone you know, if they knew that January was Blue Month and it was about human trafficking and all that, they wouldn't have a clue. And that's kind of my my downside to this. I want to see people get involved, wake up and get on it and think about it on a daily basis, because it's happening around us all the time. And we need to start, we're responsible for each other, and we need to start helping each other through these things. And I like to see the laws go further, and I like to see more of this training. It shouldn't just be in a couple of states or a couple of border guards or a couple of groups. It should be something that we're all paying attention to and we're all thinking about, and we're training all of our police, all of our hospitals, all of our service people should be aware of this, because that's the only way we're going to get a handle on it.
Right. You talk about getting a handle, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, in 2016, they arrested 300 in 2011, 938 2016, and then almost 2,000, went on almost 2,000 convictions, arrests, but you put the disturbing number, only half have been convicted out of those 2,000. And then you talk about lenient sentences, but that's incredible lack of conviction, isn't it?
Oh, it's terrible. It's terrible. And I put a few samples of stories from ICE on victims. And I think that's really important too. So that's kind of the whole driving thing for me is you've got Homeland Security and ICE that's should be the most aware and should be on top of it the most. And I'm not trying to give them grief or put them down. I respect what they do, but that only half actually anything comes from. It's just terrible. It's terrible that these things are happening to so many of the young and helpless and even poor people. I think what it does is it drives you nuts. When you go through this and you see all these stories, and I'm only scratching the surface with this book, you will see how many people, and young people, so young, have been put through this ordeal, and they've survived, and there's really no support for them, very little support, and there's really no justice for them either, because we're just not convicting them. Even when ICE can't get the job done, you know that we have to be doing something.
You also talk about in Ontario and Canada, 65% of all the human trafficking cases there in the biggest province in Canada, conviction rate 7%.
Yeah,
talk about impunity is a big problem. And you also write about 40% of countries have few or no convictions over the last 10 years. I think that's even more disturbing.
Yeah, and that's I think that's kind of, when you start getting through you know, it's like a story, you know. You come out and you hear a story and you're going through it and something bad happens and then you want that happy ending. And the problem is, in this case, you start reading these numbers and looking at the facts and you start realizing that there's no happy ending here. There's not even a Band-Aid going on here. It's really wow. It's all you can say. You know, you keep finding out more and more, and you start realizing that, wow, there's just nothing going on. Like, we're letting all this happen, and it's becoming bigger, and there's people that are getting into this business, so to speak, and they're doing it because there's really no, there's nothing, there's no bite back, you know. You've got better odds of running a trafficking business and getting through it, not convicted or even prosecuted, and making lots of money, than you do most crime rings right now. You know, drugs or it's just crazy. And mm-hmm. We're talking about human beings. Human beings is the product. That's kind of, I think, the hard thing, because this should actually be focused news. This should be the number one topic on the news, more than it is. Not the stuff they talk about now about, you know, well, you know, you turn on the news, you see, and sure. very seldom you see the story about this. And if you do, it's halfway through the news, and it's just that, oh, police picked up, you know, two people that were trafficking 14 in a some sort of ring, and you might not hear about it again because it probably won't go to court. If it does, it doesn't get conviction. It doesn't get any legs with it. So that's kind of what I hope I get across in this book.
Do you think that, I guess, with the arrest of Epstein and R. Kelly with new charges, even though he charges brought up from previously, and then I don't know if recharging him, but what my point is that the attitudinal change in society that seems kind of quickly or overnight, maybe because it's celebrity driven, and you talk about Kim Kardashian trying to help out someone that was convicted for shooting her, what other people would call a pimp. Do you think the Me Too movement is maybe some cause for optimism in this, in that those same people that created that quickly, that societal attitudinal change, might apply that energy to something like that, if someone like Kim Kardashian is weighing in on the issue?
I'm not as excited about it. You know, the whole Epstein thing, again, because how it's marketed about politics. The majority of the stories in all the networks, what are they talking about? They're talking about who was with, you know, everything you get is about, oh, here's a picture of Bill Clinton with them. Here's a picture of Donald Trump. They're best friends. It's all political, and they want to use it against each other. And we're not, again, that's all you've heard about. And that's all that's what they're making it. They're not making it about the actual victims. We're not focused in on the people that were hurt by this. We're focused in on, you've got a whole half of the country, throwing famous Democrats with them, and then you got half the country throwing famous Republicans. And it's like, that's really not what it's about. This man had done some awful things. And he's been accused of some awful things, but they're not talking about the things he did and the victims and how, what should be changed and what, and how did he, you know, get away with it for years and stuff. Other than you get a blame, you know, of someone that, oh, he gave him a light sentence because he's a Republican, or it's just I just mean the focus is somewhere else. You talk to anybody about, you know, someone, I was just interviewed for the Law Network last week about this book. And that was their focus. What do you think Epstein's going to get? What do you? Nobody cares about what's really going on, the heart of what he's doing, the business he was running, and the people that he hurt. And where are they now? And what's happened to them? And what are we going to do about that? And how do we make it so that this doesn't go on? You know, that's so I'm not as excited about it, I guess, as a lot of people might be, but because I really don't care if Trump and Clinton were on the plane with them. I mean, I care, but that my focus is on what he was doing to these people and what should happen and how do we fix this and how do we help those people, you know.
Doesn't the story, though, demonstrate Clinton, both Clinton and among other people, but Clinton and Trump fiercely, diametrically opposed, at least from that before the election and on, they represent two different things. They present two completely different views, and yet they both were friends with this guy. And this is well known. I mean, we've been hearing these rumors for years. This is not like what a surprise. So it seems to be indicative of that. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, he's a big, you know, it was just like the Harvey Weinstein or whatever. You know, it's just like these people have a lot of power. They have a lot of money and a lot of influence. So when it comes to elections, they call on these people. They hang out with these people. They're friends with these people. They party with them. They fly to the island. They do all these things because it's about getting elected. And it's about getting money from these people and getting support because someone endorses you, all of their fans, you know. So it's all kind of he was a big power with a lot of money and a lot of influence. As long as a lot of these people that are being taken down are in that situation. So it's a perfect bedfellow, if you will, bad wording, but of a politician, you know. You want these, especially in the U.S., because lobbying is really the basis of an American political system. So that's how it works. And so, unfortunately, we'll probably find all sorts of ties to him and other rich people that have done all sorts of bad things. And I don't really blame either one of them because I think they're both doing it for the same reason. You know, I don't know if they were involved. I don't think we can tell that at this point. But it should be more about what kind of a situation is drawn from rich people like this that do these things, and what kind of laws are there to prevent it, and what kind of system do we have set up for these victims? Where can they go? Who can they call? Who's going to help them? How can they get out of these situations? We need to be looking at that more than, you know, what other rich people are in there. I mean, if they were involved, they should be taken down too. If they're just friends, we can't do much about that. But, you know, so we need to be focusing really on the crime and fixing the crime. Because at this point, whatever he did do, it's kind of past tense now. He's done it. And we can't go back and change it. But we can look at that and make everyone aware of what he was doing and to who he was doing it. Who are the victims? How many people did he get, and where did he get them from? And how come they were not? Why? How come they never came forward? And how come none of their families? And like, we have to know more about really what goes on in these things. So I hope that's where it goes, but so far it hasn't really done that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a thing that you write about that. Allude to that this is the dangerous world of human trafficking, but only if we extrapolate from this information and say, how dangerous can it be in another 5 or 10 years with these kinds of unscrupulous, beyond, I mean, unscrupulous is an understatement, incredibly, that what will these people do? What will they resort to? Like you say, when criminal organizations now are using the profits of child sex slavery and other types of human trafficking to incredible profits. And if that's the case, and it is the case, then you can see nothing but a growing trend towards more and more. And if our imaginations are blown by the information that's in your book, and you are blown away by the information you uncovered from the victim stories that you include in the book, like you say, I share your lack of optimism that we will really be able to address something that's incredibly important to address.
Yeah, I can only hope for the best. You know, and even the R. Kelly thing, you know, when you talk about that, it's not really, I mean, I don't know the depths of it, but a lot of what he did was underage, having sex with underage girls and moving them across state lines, which is a bad thing. But I don't know if it's going to really help bring attention to trafficking per se and what's going on, like in the book, in the cases we covered about people being held and forced to work or have sex or taken their body parts. You know, people like that. It's what I want to get people aware of, not so much the R. Kelly thing. But that's a concern, too. I'm not, you know, saying it's okay. It's just it's not the same type of the trafficking that was going on that we covered.
I just see that if law enforcement and law enforcement and prosecutors in other countries are unable for various reasons, and there's a myriad of reasons why some countries would be reluctant, hesitant, less likely to want to prosecute because of the economies of those countries and the governments that are in, and the attitude that seems to be, if people don't care so much because they think it's just a case of prostitution. If you include a story in your book about a young girl that has a boyfriend and then she takes drugs or he introduces her, a lot of people, again, would not be as... The victim is not as sympathetic as other victims. And as we know in true crime, and you know, that it seems to be we have to have this clear-cut, virginal, pure white, beyond a very, very innocent victim for us to be able to relate. And so I find that it's interesting but disturbing, but I hope that through awareness like this book and then and a lot of the stories about human trafficking, that it will be a groundswell from society itself to look at this the right way, not to look at the myths or the misperceptions, and to be able to look at this and then take some sort of action.
Yeah, exactly. And I hope that's where it comes to, and I hope that there's been a lot of attention on the book and a lot of people talking, and it's done quite well, and I hope that it continues. I hope people pass it on, tell other people, and talk about it, and that's the only way we're going to stop it. The only way we're going to make any changes is if we all get on board.
Right. Well, Helen, I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about In Chains, The Dangerous World of Human Trafficking. It's been very, very enlightening. Thank you very much, Alan Warren, for this interview.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for taking on this subject. It's important.
Now, for those people that might want to take a look and maybe listen to your House of Mystery, tell us a little bit about websites and where they might take a look at your books. Tell us about that information.
Well, the House of Mystery is on KCAA 106.5 FM in Los Angeles, Palm Springs, and Riverside. And you can go to houseofmystery.com, of course, to get any of the old shows on podcast. And, of course, KCA itself, if you want to listen to it live. And my own books, of course, alanrwarren.com. And they're at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And in Canada now, they're in three chapters now. So chapters Indigo, and I guess hopefully even more.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Alan. It's been a pleasure. You have a great night. Hope to speak to you again soon. Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.